mighty, mighty warrior Hanuman. How do you do that? What are the key questions that you have to ask in terms of understanding the background, the history, the motivation, the inner mood? So bring a sketch pad, because Ian's conviction is that anybody can draw. Anybody. I challenged him by saying, if you can make me draw, then you ready? Then I'll believe anything you say. But he actually can.
then
you have to come to that. Yeah. So we have all these fun stuff coming up. There's Ian doing Hanuman. We've got potlucks. We've got Old Westbury Gardens. Some extraordinary special guest speakers as well over the next few weeks. Next week we're going to have Vishwambar here. Vishwambar, who is the Mridanga player and lead singer in Mayapuri.
Oh, yeah.
He will chant. He'll lead a chant. But it's mostly to talk with him. It's going to be an interview format, as we often do. What's it like growing up in that second wave, that second generation of yogis, bhakti yogis, who are there because their parents had some connection with that community? That's a first in American history. That's never happened before, that there was a generation of parents so committed to devotional yoga that children are now being brought up in a devotional environment in America. That's if it wasn't in my generation. Okay, so we'll start with Arti. And we just chant Hare Krishna during this Arti. Is there anybody who's not familiar with the Arti ceremony? If you're not sure what it is, raise your hand. It's okay. You won't get demerits or points off. So everybody knows what the Arti ceremony is. So if I said to you, this is the Mahabhuta offering to Bhagavan, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So you keep standing. I'm going to sit and play harmonium. And first a prayer to the spiritual master. And then we'll chant responsively the Hare Krishna mantra.
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna,
Krishna, Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama.
Yadunath's birthday today. So a big happy birthday to Yadunath. Happy birthday. As they say in devotee circles, may this be your last. Or something like that. No, no, not your last. May you not take birth again. Right. This your last could be your God. Right. That's not. Krishna, dear Yaduna,
Hare Krishna to you. May you never taste birth again.
Okay, we're done now. We're done. Thank you. Thank you. It was a good idea. We just want to push it too far. Yes, indeed, indeed. Okay, quickly, once around the room, just say your name and one really exciting thing that happened this week in 30 seconds or less, if you had something exciting happen within 30 seconds or less. Rodney, let's start with you.
Are you going to time us?
No. No, it's approximate. It's flex. It's Indian time.
Every day is a beautiful day.
Oh, thank you. That was great. Did everyone hear what he said?
Yes.
Thank you, Rodney. All right, your name and something extraordinary.
My name is Alice, and I had lunch with 3-year-olds from their nutrition episode.
Oh. What do you serve to 12 3-year-olds?
Well, I didn't prepare the meal. It's a head start.
Uh-huh. Okay.
At a NYCHA housing development. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
We have some extraordinary people who, I don't know if you guys understand how really special this group is, you know, the people who come to these Tuesday gatherings. You've got Alice over here doing her Head Start program. You've got to explain a little bit for people what you do. I'm just going to jump the line just a little because it's absolutely amazing. Can you give a brief overview? Say your name and then just give a brief overview for people. I mean, it's just. Thank you for what you're doing and for what you're doing.
Yes, exciting.
Yes. When you're gone, we miss you, but we know you're doing good work, so that's important. All right, back over here, Lauren. Say hi to everyone. No, this isn't comparing careers here. That wasn't the point. Everybody here is extraordinary. Good for you. That was a big leap you took to do that, I think.
Thank
you, writing. So it's beginning to bear fruit, is it?
Yes.
Nice.
Yes.
Very, very nice. Good for you. Now you're going to have to say your name again. Agnieszka. Ah, Agnieszka. Very, very nice. Agnieszka is a...
Doing
apprenticeship here at Jiva Mukti with, who is your teacher?
Himana.
With Himana, whom we have been missing, actually. We haven't seen her for a little while, too. So welcome.
I'm her first
apprentice. Wow, very good. Very nice, very nice. Good for you. Well, thank you for joining us. Say hi to the folks.
Yeah, my name is Amitabh, and I'm excited to be here. And I was missing the months of March. And good thing that happened this weekend, I was in Washington, D.C. My mom celebrated her 75th birthday. So I had a lot of people and family come to Toronto and all over.
That's where your accent's from.
That's a good one, yeah.
Well, happy birthday to your mom. You got a lot of birthdays coming here. Like you. Mm. You? Yeah.
Yes. My name is Yaakov Nath. And the amazing thing that happened this week was a room full of pious souls just wishing me a happy birthday and encouraged me not to get birthday.
Very nice.
Yadunath is not only an old and dear friend, but...
older now.
Older now. But also a truly gifted teacher of... theatrical and comedic improvisation.
Oh, cool.
And I think one day I would like to ask you to lead us in some exercises. You've described some of them for me. And I think this group would be responsive and appreciative for some, particularly the exercise you describe where it's about relinquishing control.
Everybody's really willing to do that, right?
Yeah, that's our favorite thing here. We practice relinquishing control, yeah. So maybe someday we can ask you to do that for us.
Yeah,
Great, thank you. We have a visiting yoga instructor from New Jersey. Purnima is now with the Jiva Mukti New Jersey contingency.
Yes, we're in chapter one. I kind of got more.
Just as long as the studio is not already in chapter 11, you're fine.
No, that's fine. You must visit. Good. I think our Krishna altar is extraordinary.
They have a beautiful altar.
It is. Mm-hmm.
It's
there.
It's a real deity, and the altar is feeding the deity every day.
That's fantastic. That's amazing.
We found him
in a garage. Uh-huh. And it's an authorized deity.
Yes.
Lord and I with our mouths dropped.
Well, that's real temple standards. That's great. Great. Wonderful.
Sorry.
Glad you could make it.
Busy you are. If I could just offer two things that are extraordinary is during this past month of Bhakti and in reading your book, because what I found is that I was not ready, in many ways, to understand Gita. It's only come from time. So sometimes the page is just open to something I needed to read. And at times it was chapter 6. And then I was exploring, of course, chapter 4. And it's like chapter 10, 11, and 12. And everything about what bhakti is about satsang, kirtan, finding the correct teacher, asking the teacher, the lineage, mm-hmm. and everything was remarkable. And then I didn't get to your Nama Rupa issue that you're in. He's a Nama Rupa. It's a magazine, and he did a thing about George Harrison. It's really wonderful. Please read it. I was looking at Netta Devotion, mm-hmm. and I was trying to understand some of the taste. I haven't bought the book yet. But the Nama Rupa issue in Winter talk about how Sri Ketavi Joyce talked about how pilgrimage was called bhakti, you know, going to the temple sites, mm-hmm. giving honor to deities. And he said, but then you also can just do it on your mat. You don't really have to leave, it's your intention right there. Mm-hmm. So I just want to say that the focus of the month, in my trying to understand bhakti and my own issues with it, I was glad to have used wisdom to open its wisdom to me.
Well, aren't you nice? Thank you. It's always nice to be of some, thank you for some help somehow. So delighted that you're here.
I am too.
Making progress. Say hi to the gang.
Hello. So my name is Lucy. And something wonderful that happened, I listened to a talk this week, Ramapada Swami, is that his
mm-hmm.
name?
Yep.
And he mentioned your name, and he talked a little bit about what your plans together might be. And so I was just a little extra inspired to come here this evening.
Oh, I'm so glad. Great, thank you. Ramapada Swami is one of the first devotees I knew when I came to New York in 1971. It was summertime. He was standing on the steps of the Brooklyn Krishna Temple, which was on Henry Street at the time. And he has the same expression today that he did in the summer of 1971. He's this absolutely, the word in the Gita is samatva. He's just equipoised. Always calm under any condition. In fact, that's going to be in our verse today. We're going to talk about achieving that kind of equanimity under all circumstances.
Not so easy.
Especially around tax time. You want to say hi, Michael Prabhu?
That's right.
I got a scholarship to the... What's the name of the school?
I got a scholarship through the Vaishnava Association to go to the Integrative School of Nutrition.
Integrative School of Nutrition, right. That's on 34th Street, right?
Yeah. Yeah. What am I going to do? I have an idea. Mm-hmm. Maybe if Yadanath wants to do it, we can do a play here. If he's a director, we can do a play one night in the home.
Well, there are so many things we could do. Just put a pin in it for tonight. We'll make a list of possible futures. Sure, we can always do that. All right, you're up. It's your turn. Yeah. Tiana's another one of those extraordinary people you never know about unless you know, which is that she works in healthcare and is another healthcare provider and someone whose heart is very big and who's concerned for the well-being of others. And we're honored by your presence here whenever you can join us. Thank you. Share.
Yep.
O ye of centrality in our Tuesday gatherings.
I taught, was it last week or the week before maybe? I taught a sacred mandala class, and looking at the historical and spiritual significance of mandalas throughout many cultures, the Hindu culture, American Indian, Celtic, and so forth, and looking at the meanings and how they represented history in the cultures and countries that they were born in, and how the use of mandalas and looking at mandalas and allowing yourself to be open and inspired by mandalas can make a difference in your own lives, and how you can even draw your own sacred mandala and what it means to you by setting your intention and opening yourself up for meditation so that the information comes through you and you can draw. And you don't have to be an artist or have taken, you know, art classes to do this. It's phenomenal, the work that comes through people.
When is your next class?
It's going to be on May 11th.
So if anyone would be interested in a mandala class on May 11th, please see Sherry. Well, thank you. Okay. Rishabh, how you been?
Pretty good.
Fine, thank you. Anything interesting this week that you'd like to report in about?
Yeah, I just I've been applying for this position of a volunteer at this organization by the name of the Acumen Fund, and they finally accepted my application, so I start my work as a volunteer with them tomorrow.
Oh, congratulations. There's a lot of announcements here today. That's great. Terrific.
Yes. It's terrific. A venture capitalist sort of a firm. Mm-hmm. And they invest in businesses in Western Africa, Pakistan, India, and Eastern Europe. And what they look for in New York is people who can help them organize charity events that raise money so that they can invest.
If anybody knows any journalists, I think somebody should do an article about the people who come here on Tuesday. This is an amazing group, absolutely amazing. Well, thank you for all the good work you're doing. Ms. Heckel.
I'm just very grateful to be here because I teach here on Tuesday morning. I live in New Jersey, so I go home. Sometimes it's an effort to get back here. And usually today I got a phone call. Can you teach tonight? I was like, no. Usually I say yes, but I'm like, no, I don't have any plans for tonight. So I'm very grateful to be here.
Karen's also an old friend, and we've done a lot of stuff together. Always great having you here. Thank you. Ian, how are you doing?
I'm just happy to be here with all of you. And hear all these stories. I've been just working and doing my job and doing my daily life, and it's always a blessing.
Now, you're a carpenter, aren't you?
No, I'm an artist, so I have a print shop. And but I've been building a cloud furniture to work with a special dust in the studio, so I've been building a last few days, and it has this handle that you kind of turn like this, and it raises a cloud of dust that you can settle on a plate and work with this dust on the plate.
Wow. Okay. That sounds exciting. Never heard of anything like that before. That's great. Well, we're going to have to see some of your work sometime, too. Anantadev, how are you today?
I'm a monk, I don't just dress this way just because it looks cool. That's one of the reasons. So, generally, I'm trying to avoid the exciting.
Let's just finish. We have two other friends we want to say hello to, and then we'll get it going.
I'm Tony.
Thank you for being with us.
I'm Julie, and I would like, if you guys wouldn't mind, on the count of three,
Oh, that's good.
Okay. Okay.
Right.
One, two, three.
Hi, Sandra!
She's a Bhakti sister podcast lamb who used to come and now lives in Nashville. And I've been waiting for this moment. And she hears it. She's
great idea. Sandra's another one of these incredible souls that they just, you know, they descend from some Edenic planet or something. She left New York to go to Nashville, where she is teaching yoga therapy and doing extraordinary things. I mean, really demonstrating the therapeutic value of yoga. I mean, yoga operates on many levels. We may not always be aware of it, but there's the physical, there's the mental, there's a therapeutic, you might almost say a psychological dimension to yoga. Then, of course, there's the transcendental dimension to yoga. So on all of these different levels, the effective and informed practice of yoga, I think we need to make that stipulation, not just any yoga. But yoga, when practiced under the guidance of a qualified teacher with the right intent, can affect amazing changes on many, many different levels. So, okay. Welcome, one and all. If you have your Bhagavad Gita, please open to... In the paperback edition, it's page 248. I'm not sure what page it is. In the hardbound edition, it's 6th chapter... Verse 7. We're continuing a discussion we started last week on the nature of the mind. It's the very first goal, the very first objective of yoga practice is to bring the mind under control, to withdraw the mind from the external distractions of the world, and to corral the mind into being our friend. We read last week that the mind can be our best friend or our worst enemy. And there are stories of this throughout the sacred texts of sages and rishis and yogis and teachers and students who have come to grips with their own mind as the mountain that has to be overcome in order to progress in spiritual practice. There was one rishi named Shorab Rishi who meditated underwater for something like 1,000 celestial years. I mean, yogis can merge the outgoing and incoming breath to a place where their metabolic level drops so low that they're in a kind of suspended animation, and they can live like that for hundreds and hundreds of years. Prabhupada, my teacher, used to talk about going to the Kumbh Mela festival in India, which is an event that takes place. The big event is every 12 years there. I think that's called Magh Mela. And it's at the confluence. It's at Hyderabad, right? The confluence of three sacred rivers. And the yogis who are always distant from civilization, living in the highest regions of the Himalayas and in caves and in forests, for this one event every 12 years, they come down to take their bath in this confluence of three rivers because at that moment it's considered instant liberation. It's such a sacred time astrologically and in terms of the effect and the benefit of being there with so many other holy people. And you will see people who look quite young, 30s, 40s, and yet they're hundreds of years old, who practice this very intense form of mystic yoga where they arrest the breathing process and go... So here's this Sohrab Rishi who practiced this kind of severe mystic yoga underwater for 100 celestial years, or however long it was, I don't recall now, who opened his eyes and saw two fish copulating and lost it. The whole, just lost it. The whole thing. So all it took was one little distraction and bingo, all gone. Because the mind can be swayed. And what is it all? I mean, that particular story tells us also that no amount of mechanical yoga practice will control the mind. There's only one way to control the mind. What is the one force in the universe that is so powerful? Thank you. One thing that can control the mind permanently is love. Bhakti. If you are in a loving relationship with Krishna, who dwells in the heart, we're going to read about that as well in this verse, then you have some higher engagement to give the mind. The mind, like a child, if you've ever worked with young children, you can't just, you know, sit down and don't do anything. You have to give them some other activity to engage them. The mind is like that, like a reckless child running around. Lots of energy, lots of enthusiasm, but not very mature. So you've got to give that mind some higher engagement. Anyway, there are so many stories like that of the mind being the best friend or the worst enemy.
So who is Saurabh Muni?
Who was Saurabh Muni? What is his backstory, you mean? I don't know enough about him to tell you. Most of these rishis started off as people in family life. And at some point along the way, they got the inspiration, either by meeting a teacher or reading sacred texts or going to a place of pilgrimage, and decided to dedicate their life to spiritual practice. There is a king, Kulashekar. This is a lovely verse that Prabhupada frequently chanted, a prayer by King Kulashekar. Another example of someone who was in politics, married, family, running a government, and then got that inspiration and just wanted to give himself completely to Krishna and wrote many beautiful prayers. This is one verse of one prayer. Krishna tvadeya padapang karapunjarandam advaiva vishitumi manasarajaham. So, prana prayana kavaye kavavat pittu kandarvado sanavido sananam kutaste. I'm not sure I got all of that right, but the basic idea is, at this moment, my dear Krishna, I'm in a peaceful frame of mind. Life's okay right now. Nothing's particularly distracting me. I'm thinking of you, so let me die now. Let the swan of my mind, manasa paramahansa, let the hansa of my manasa, let the swan of my mind entangle itself in the stem of your lotus feet. Now what swans do, swans have this little game they play. If you've ever watched swans disporting on a pond where there are lotus flowers, swans like to duck their head under the water and twirl their neck around the stem of the lotus flower. So here's King Kulashekar saying, let the swan of my mind embrace that stem, that root of your lotus-like feet. And because now, in a peaceful frame of mind, I can think of you. At the time of death, kavaye kapapittapayu kandarbaro danabido smaranam kutaste. Kapapittu, all the elements of the body are stopped up and you can't breathe well, and death can be a very disruptive thing. So he says, who knows what my fate will be at some other moment. I don't know whether smaranam kutaste, whether I'll be able to smaranam, be able to remember you at that moment. So let me die now while I'm thinking. My mind is engaged in thinking of you. Anyway, the texts are filled with all of these stories about engaging the mind, which is really what yoga is all about. Okay, so continuing our discussion of the mind, this is the seventh verse of the sixth chapter. Would you please repeat the Sanskrit after me? First, the invocation. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Bhagavad Gita 6:7. Jitatmanak prashantasya paramatma samahitaha shitoshna sukadukeshu tata mana pamanayo. Jitatmanak prashantasya. You try that. Jitatmana prashantasya paramatma samahitaha. Shitoshna sukadukeshu tata mana pamanayo. Now there are certain words and phrases that you'll find repeated in the Bhagavad Gita. For example, this phrase shitoshna sukadukha. There's a verse earlier in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna tells Arjuna, let's see, how does that verse begin? It'll come to me in a moment. Sitoshna sukha dukkha da agama paino nityastam statikshasva bharata. That the temporary appearance and disappearance of pleasures and pains, of distress and happiness, are like summer and winter seasons. The sukha and the dukkha, the pleasurable moments and the unpleasurable moments, come and go like the seasons. And if you keep that in mind, you can become equipoised. They don't need to disturb you as much. If all you have to meditate on is the sensation of the moment, it's going to be very awkward. Pains are never pleasurable, and pleasures don't last very long. And they're usually followed by pain. So the worldview of the Gita is just as you don't have to find the time to go to look for pain. Pain finds you out. You don't have to mark time off in your afternoon. From 3 to 4 today, I'm going to go looking for something painful. Painful circumstances find us out in this life, according to our gunas and karma. And so similarly, happiness will find you out. You don't have to go looking for it. It's not necessary for you to strive to maximize your happiness. Those conditions will be arranged by other outside influences. That's settled up. By achieving a steady internal condition, which we might call spiritual happiness, ultimately, ananda, that sense of I am an eternal soul. Whatever goes on here in the outside world, well, that's, you know, the nature of things. That's that samatva, that's that steadiness that the yogis achieve. So here this verse says, for one who has conquered the mind, jita atmaha. Atma, we read last week, can, depending on the circumstance, can mean mind, senses, body, soul, humanity, the universe, the supreme being. According to the context, that one word has so many different meanings. Here, it refers to the mind. For one who has conquered the mind, if you have conquered your mind, Krishna says, the supersoul is already reached, for such a person has attained tranquility. Tranquility. is equal, according to this verse, to achieving knowledge of God in your heart. Paramatma is the localized form of Krishna. There are three forms that Krishna takes. The Supreme Being appears as the all-pervading Brahman energy of which everything is constituted. He appears as the Paramatma, local feature, God in the heart, that inner voice of wisdom and guidance is called Paramatma. And then he appears in his original transcendental form as Krishna, two-armed, playing the flute with a peacock feather in his hair, wearing a flower garland, eyes like blooming lotus petals, utterly irresistible. The cowherd women, one turns to the other and says at one moment in the bhakti texts, "If you're still interested, my dear friend, in any of the pleasures of this world, society, hanging out with people, friends, doing something, you know, just be, whatever you, that's fine, but whatever you do, don't go down by the Yamuna River. Because that boy is down there. That Krishna is down by the Yamuna River. And if you get one look at him, all of this other stuff is finished. You'll never be able to go back to it again." So these three aspects, right? Knowing Krishna in that original irresistible form of Bhagavan, in his original two-armed form playing the flute, that ultimate cause of all causes, original originating point of all other creation, all other manifestations, expansions, universes, galaxies, material elements, the senses, the mind, everything ultimately finding its way back to the original source, which is endowed with shape, form, individuality, personhood, and this utterly irresistible appearance. That's the ultimate goal. To get there, there are progressive stages, and the first stage is just being aware, coming to a point of, well, there's something to this. There's something here. I don't quite know what it is, but it seems to be making some sense to me. It resonates with me somehow. These teachings and these mantras and all that stuff, you know. I'm not quite sure I get it, but I kind of like it, you know, or maybe even better, it makes me uncomfortable. It takes me out of my usual comfortable space and puts me in something that seems more important somehow. You start there with that little degree of faith, and then it progresses to associating with others on the path, to giving up hurtful or unproductive habits, cleaning up your act, so to speak. These are the various progressive stages toward pure love for that cowherd boy on the banks of the Yamuna River. For one who has conquered the mind, the super soul, the preliminary stage of knowing Krishna here in the heart, is already reached, for he has attained tranquility. To such a man, happiness and distress, heat and cold. That's the verse. Matra sparshastu konteya. Matra sparshastu konteya. Sitoshna sukha dukkha da. Agamo apayino nityas. Tamstatikshasva bharata. Don't let these external changes throw you for a loop. If you're well grounded through your yoga practice, through the chanting of mantras, through proper diet, you know, plays an awfully big role in consciousness. It really does. Prabhupada used to say one time, tamas means food in darkness, you know, like things that are pickled, marinated, old, unclean in some form. He used to say, tamasic food, tamasic intelligence. I mean,
you are what you eat.
It, depending on the kind of what you put in, that's what comes out. And a healthy diet, even though it may require a little bit more time, makes a real difference in how you feel, how you think, and how you speak. Prabhupada says, actually, every living entity is intended to abide by the dictation of the Supreme, personality of Godhead, who is seated in everyone's heart as Paramatma. When the mind is misled by the external illusory energy, one becomes entangled in material activities. Entangled in... It doesn't mean that if you're leading a yogic life, a bhakti life, that you don't have any material activities anymore. It means that you don't become entangled in them. That's a big difference. That's a really big difference. That old Buddhist saying, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. The activities of your life don't change, but the joy with which you perform them is dramatically different. Because all of a sudden, the simplest thing becomes revealed as the hand of God. And it becomes an inspiration. Every little moment can be an inspiration. Everything can be an inspiration.
So if you were entangled in the material world, you wouldn't find it that way. You wouldn't find inspiration at what you were doing if you were entangled.
Well, even proficient yogis who understand intellectually that these activities have a divine quality to them can still become entangled. You know, until we reach that place of utter, pure, unadulterated, unalloyed love for Krishna. Until you've reached that place, there's every chance. Who was I saying?
But I was just thinking, what does that mean to be entangled?
Entangled. Okay.
What does that mean?
Entangled means, first of all, that you've become anxious. The first sign that you've become entangled in your material activities is that doing them brings you some anxiety. Dukkha means, yeah, distress, sure. That there's some uncertainty over the outcome, and that's distressing. There's uncertainty about whether I actually have the skills and the qualifications for doing this task. That's anxiety producing. There's projecting. What happens if I don't get it right? What are the consequences going? So we humans, we suffer three times for everything. We suffer from thinking about what might happen. Then we suffer from what happened. And then we suffer because we're thinking about how much it went wrong and how much we're suffering. So, you know, we're past, present, and future. We love just maximize suffering, you know, as much as possible. It's over. It's history. I'm still suffering. All right, confession time. I forgot who I said I was going to do this. This past week, for the first time in many, many, many years, I lost it. I lost it big time. I got so angry. I mean, really, really angry. It was someone I loved dearly. Not Esther. It's not my mom. I'm not going to tell you who it is. But this person, we had something that we've been trying to do for a long time, and there was an opportunity to pursue a possible lead for getting it done. I'm going to be as vague as possible here. we always consult with one another because it's a project that we're developing together. So we always consult. So I consulted and said, here's the opportunity. What do you think? Let's go after this. Sure, provided, this person says, these conditions. No problem. I send off an email. We'd like to pursue a discussion, provided these conditions. Copy my friend. Response comes back. That whole email was wrong. It was vague. It didn't specify what the ground rules are. It was the... And I realized that there has been, over many, many years, a lot of anger building up. See, things don't happen like that. They don't. When you find yourself responding to to something with extreme emotion of one kind or another, there's usually a long history that's led up to that moment. What's happened in that moment is a trigger to something that has been there for a very, very long time. And in this case, for me, what I was realizing was, even though we're so close, we love each other dearly, and this project has been such an important thing for us, I've never felt that I had the confidence of this person to go and develop it on the business side. And consequently, all of my conversations on behalf of this project have been compromised. And it's been so long, and I guess one of my attachments is that if I undertake something, I want to complete it. That's described in the Bhagavad Gita as action in the mode of goodness. It's actually a good quality. But if you become entangled in it, meaning that you allow it to define your sense of self-worth, then you will become vulnerable to these emotions of bitterness, anger, hostility, disappointment, whatever it may be. Instead of acknowledging that I am an eternal soul, everything we do should be undertaken in a spirit of devotion. And whatever the result may be, that's actually out of our hands. That's a really hard thing to do. To just do something to the best of your ability without really becoming thoroughly enmeshed in the outcome. Very, very difficult thing. Because we grew up in a culture that's all about the outcome. In fact, the outcome in this culture is all that matters. Read the newspaper. Cheat, steal, lie, bribe, whatever you got to do. It's the outcome that matters in this culture. Right? How many times have we've been, it's headline news. Somebody has to step down for this impropriety, or this company is fined 30 million, billion, trillion, quadzillion dollars for their impropriety. Huh?
Or
they get away with it. So the message that's coming across here is that there's another way, there's another state of being, in which case you remain unaffected, if you will. You're not entangled in the work that you have to do. Now, that doesn't mean that you're not concerned with the quality of what you do. It doesn't mean that you've become indifferent to it. This was a simple saying that Prabhupada used to have. If it's worth doing for Krishna, it's worth doing right. And whatever you do, you can do for Krishna, whether it's washing the dishes or taking out the laundry or cleaning your room or taking care of, paying the bills or whatever you have to do. It's hard, but it can be done. It can be done. Mostly by coming to know Krishna. If you don't know, you can't love someone you don't know. So it's coming to know Krishna. And I will assume responsibility for really not having told you enough Krishna stories here on Tuesdays. I think that would be a lovely thing to do. Michael's always upbraiding me for not bringing enough Krishna stories into the class. So should I tell one Krishna story?
Yes.
Let's find one story about Krishna. Okay. That has to do with this verse. That's the trick here. I have to make it relevant to the verse. Okay. So Mother Yashoda was entangled in her service to Krishna one time, her child. And how did that happen? Well, in the Vedic village habit, you make your own yogurt. There's no Stonyfield factory. You make your own yogurt. And because the children are always stealing the yogurt, in the pots, the women, the mothers, tie the pots up by strings. There are holes in the sides of the pots, so you've got strings.
and they tie them up on hooks on the ceiling. So they're above where children can reach. And that's how they store them, in these clay pots. The clay keeps them cool. Clay retains the coolness. So Mother Yashoda came to the room where she keeps these. The pots were all broken and the yogurt was all over the place. And, you know, she didn't think it was the monkeys, even though the monkeys are always getting into some mischief in Vrindavan. So she hides out and she watches. And sure enough, here comes Krishna with his stick. You know, the cowherd boys herd the calves. The fathers do the cows, but the boys, they do the calves. And they have little sticks, so they're kind of getting them back into the herd. But with that stick, Krishna had stood up on a upside-down jar and had poked holes in the yogurt pots. And he was just staying there, letting the yogurt drip into his mouth. And then, when he was full, taking gobs of it in his hands and giving it out to the monkeys. So the monkeys are all running around with, you know, yogurt. And Mother Yashoda is looking at him saying, "What are you doing?" She said, "You're so naughty. I was saving that yogurt for you. I was going to give it to you anyway. Right, so you can, you know, grow nice and fatty." That's the way Prabhupada said. "There you go, you can grow nice and fatty. I'm just going to give you that yogurt. And now you've gone and spoiled everything." Krishna looked at her and smiled and said, "No, you don't understand." He said, "These are not ordinary monkeys. These monkeys are very, very great yogis. For thousands of births, they have been practicing yoga so that we could be together here in Vrindavan. So this is my way of showing my love for them." "You don't have to worry," he said. "It's fine." So in the spiritual realm, there's competition. You know, all of these qualities that we are talking about having to master, you know, anger and bitterness, you know, all these things, you know, up and down, those are actually reflections of the original emotions in the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, there is anger, there is fear, there is anxiety, there's hysteria, there's compassion. You know, all of the emotions that we experience are there in the eternal realm, on the level of the soul. That's where the emotions come from. But we're experiencing them here like light filtered through a colored lens. It's not pure. Anxiety here diminishes our lifespan. You know, it literally cuts into our health and well-being. Anxiety in the spiritual world, such as Mother Yashoda has for child Krishna, or the anxiety of the residents of Krishna's village when he appears to be in danger. There was a snake named Kaliya with 1,000 hoods. And Kaliya had been chased away from the place he used to live. And he had taken up residence in the Yamuna River in Vrindavan. And Kaliya breathed not only fire and smoke, poison from his many hoods, hooded mouths, and he was poisoning the water. And in fact, at one point in the story, the cowherd children come and they drink the water of the Yamuna River and they die. They literally die. And Krishna comes and says to Kaliya, no. And he jumps off of a tree into the river and swims after Kaliya to confront him, to fight him, to get him to leave the Yamuna River. So at first, because Krishna likes to play, he let Kaliya wrap him in his coils. So here's this young child, at the time I think Krishna must have been 6 or 7 or something like that, wrapped up in the coils of this huge 1,000 hooded serpent. And all of the residents of Vrindavan village are on the bank of the river and they're fainting and they're screaming and they're tearing their hair out. And the anxiety that they had was beyond imagining. beyond imagining how distressed they were that their beloved Krishna was in such mortal danger. Krishna saw this and he realized, I better do something about it. I don't want them to be in such anxiety. So he started to expand his body and expanded it and expanded and expanded until he broke Kaliya's hold on him. And then Krishna jumped up on his hoods and started dancing on Krishna's hoods from one hood to the other. And he was just having a grand old time of dancing on top of Kaliya's hoods. And all of the residents of Vrindavan and the cowherd men and women and the children were ecstatic seeing Krishna's victory dance on the hoods of the Kaliya serpent. And then Kaliya, from all of this pounding on his hoods, coughed up all of his poison, was purified of that distressed condition. And then Krishna says, I hope you don't take this personally. He says, this really is nothing personal. But I'm sworn to protect my friends and family here in Vrindavan, so I can't allow you to poison the river anymore. Would you mind terribly if I had to ask you to leave? So Kaliya left the Vrindavan river.
Where does a thousand-hooded snake go?
Where does a thousand-hooded snake go? I don't know the answer.
Kaliya from the first...
I'm not sure. But that anxiety, the point is, that anxiety is not like our anxiety. That anxiety is ecstasy. See, when we're feeling anxious, we forget that we're eternal beings. And the anxiety subconsciously reflects our own sense of mortality. Why do we become afraid or anxious? It's because we feel someone can harm us. Something can do us harm. In the eternal realm, the residents of that realm of enlightenment have no doubts of their own immortality. So there's no reason to be anxious. The only reason to be anxious is in that ecstasy of love for Krishna. That kind of anxiety is like icing on the cake. It's an embellishment to an existing eternal love that the soul has for the Supreme Being. That's a whole other kind of anxiety. So you can't compare the two emotions. Anyway, that's where you get to after you've conquered the mind. Yeah.
Are we
going to
chant it?
Are we going to chant it? Didn't we chant? We recited it. Usually you do. I don't know why I didn't today. Maybe because we had a kirtan before.
Is that what they do in Jersey?
No, you know what? We actually go through an exposition as well as we did a projection, and then we went to chapter 1, and then we went to different things, and we went through an exposition.
Sounds familiar from that reminds me of 8 years ago, so it's like Vita.
Yeah, we used to do those PowerPoints. We can bring some of those back. So but sticking to the verse for a moment, let's just stick with this. This is an important topic. You know, the nature of the mind, which is what the first thing we learn in yoga, is to bring the mind under control by giving it higher engagement, which is what the chanting is all about. Chanting you can do anywhere, that you can always do. Please understand something. I'm thinking back on some of the things that you all said when we first started our discussion this evening and the amazing things that you're doing. The world does not become simpler just because you're chanting Hare Krishna. The challenges that you have to face do not disappear. That's a mistaken idea that somehow yoga is going to simplify life. Now, there's a word that appears here in this verse. Prashantasya. Prashantasya. Attaining shanti. Attaining tranquility. Shanti is not the same thing as, like being mellow. That's not what shanti means. Shanti does not mean all of a sudden there's no stress in your life. you know, it's like the ultimate quaalude. You're just, you know, so relaxed. It's shanti man, you know. It's all cool. That may be the image of shanti. Shanti means something quite different. Shanti means that you are stable, whatever the external conditions are. And that might mean having to be in a state of real alert, energized, ready to act. So it's not a relinquishing of anything. It's a sharpening. When we think about people who have achieved a degree of proficiency in what they do, or discipline in what they do, what are some examples of people who are disciplined? Doctors, all right. Who else?
Athletes.
Who else?
Yogis.
Yogis, huh?
Gandhi.
Gandhi. Did you say Gandhi? Gandhi, all right. Who else was disciplined? Who
Sharon
else?
David.
Sharon and David. All right. So we said yogis. What other kinds of people demonstrate musicians have to be disciplined?
Prabhupada.
Okay, we're getting very person specific now, but actors have to be disciplined, certainly.
Lawyers.
All right. Military people. Armies run on discipline. So basically, what we've just said is, huh?
Parents.
Have to know how to use discipline appropriately, certainly. What we've just said, if you kind of put all that together, is every field of human endeavor, in its most refined form, operates on some principle of discipline. The enlightened life is also a disciplined life. Now, we don't live in an environment that encourages that. Discipline is considered, that's very old school, you know, to use discipline. But that's the only way the mind comes under control, is with discipline. You cannot negotiate with your mind. The mind will come under control through discipline. So your regular daily practice, you've got to continue doing that. And from that point, everything else will flow. Anyway, I'm done. All right, what else? Good enough. God. This fellow just prattles on forever. Comments, questions, stories of your own, yes, rascal mind?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, fear in the spiritual world is fear in the material world is fear of ultimate separation, losing something that you consider essential to your well-being, fear of being hurt. Again, our own mortality. We're afraid of things that will harm us. We're afraid of being alone. We're afraid of not being able to fulfill the responsibilities that we have. You know, we all pretty much know what are the triggers of fear. We're afraid of being attacked. You know, we're afraid of going hungry. We're afraid of seeing our children suffer. I mean, there's many triggers to fear in the material world. The eternal realm, that paramavyoma atmosphere that's described in the sacred texts, first of all, life is eternal, so there's no fear of death. The body is made of pure spirit and does not depend on food, so you're never afraid of going without food. Relationships there are built on unmotivated pure love with Krishna at the center. So there's never any fear of being afraid, because you're always surrounded by loving company.
Then it sounds like there's no fear.
The fear that occurs there is like the anxiety we just described, of an embellishment to the love. For example, the fear might be, let's take the same example of Mother Yashoda. she might be afraid that Krishna is going to get into trouble because he's just a child. And if he wanders too close to the river, he might fall in and drown. Now, Krishna is the supreme Godhead. He's not going to drown. But her anxiety, that maternal instinct of fear for his well-being, is a kind of impulse, an impetus to a more ecstatic expression of love for God. That's in a parental relationship. If you go to a relationship of friendship, the cowherd girls and the cowherd boys, sometimes they'll think that Krishna will, he's being attacked by some malicious ogre or some evil doer, right? And they're afraid for him. There isn't much fear for their own well-being. The only time fear for one's own well-being comes in is in those even deeper relationships where your love for Krishna is the love that a lover has for a beloved. And then the fear is he might leave me. Now, of course, ultimately Krishna never leaves us. Ishvara sarvabhutanam hridayesh, he's in the heart, right? He's always there. But the fear that he might leave us, that anxiety, that additional dimension of anxiety, is a transcendental fear, if you will. And it doesn't diminish, it enhances. So that's the... Always diminishes. These emotions in the material world wear at our nerves. They're toxic. They age us. They distract us from focus. They're harmful to ourselves and to others. That's a distorted reflection of the original emotions of the soul. Yes, and then share.
So basically what you're saying is that all of the fears in the spiritual realm are just an expression of love for Krishna, and that ultimately it's going to bring us closer to Krishna.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct. There are what are called the primary rasas, and then there are secondary rasas. The primary rasas, or emotions, or expressions of love, are five in number. There is shanta rasa, which is a passive awareness, just always meditating and thinking about Krishna. There is a dasya rasa, which is a mood of servitude. I want to do something for you because you are the supreme, I am your servant. A little bit deeper primary rasa is sakya, friendship, because in friendship it's a love of equals. Not you're above me and I'm below you, but now we're equals. The fourth primary rasa is vatsalya, that's parental, like Madhya Yashoda and the other senior men and women of Vrindavan who feel toward Krishna as a parent would toward a child. So not God the Father, but God the Son. God, my child, my beloved child, whom I must feed. I have to feed him or go hungry. And then ultimately, Madhurya Rasa, the conjugal affection that the souls in their highest expression of love for Krishna experience, which is, you take me any way you want me. You do to me anything you want. I don't care what anybody thinks. I'm yours. I am yours. Totally unfettered, unrestrained, unqualified by social rules, regulations, what the world thinks. Let them think what they want. I'm Krishna's. Secondary rasas are fear. There's a comic rasa, humorous secondary rasa. You know, it's like a joking relationship. So there are many, many of those. And they're like, if you cook, you know there's a primary taste to the food. And then all of these little spices, they enhance that primary taste. So you have all these secondary flavors going on. Love is like that. Love is like that. There's a primary feeling. And then it's enhanced by all these little things. Sometimes lovers will just be friends. Sometimes lovers might act like parent and child with one another. You know, sometimes they serve the other person. You know, sometimes they're just thinking about it. So all of those other rasas are included there, and it's makes for a nice, tasty meal. Share.
I remember when I was younger, more of a practicing Christian, I remember the statement that used to get me through difficult moments was, this too shall pass.
Hmm.
And that just reminds me a little bit of that. And I know this weekend, I had to sing a very, very large memorial event. And while I was sitting there, I was very nervous about having to sing. And earlier in the day, I was thinking about how to get out of it. And, you know, because it was such an important event about for a memorial for a very important man. And so I was just like, oh, I don't want to get up in your church and screw it up, you know. So I was going through all this stuff in my head. And while the other people were singing before me, I thought to myself, well, why are you here? You know, and I said, well, I'm here because Kobe asked me to sing at this event. And I said, but this is all about love here. This is all about the love of this man who's passed on. So you didn't know him, but you know her. So come from the love that you have for her and make this about service to her.
Hmm.
And so when I got up there, you know, I said what I had to say about the gentleman, and then I looked and I said, if I may have the liberty, I'd like to sing this song on the behalf of Julie, singing to her beloved Paul.
Oh, how nice.
And it totally shifted my focus. So I wasn't worried about forgetting the words or messing up the notes or anything. It was just totally there with her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just amazing, you know, how that perspective of where you're coming from and what we talked about before, what was, like, what's the healing element was love, love was the stronger than anything else. And,
yeah. Thank you. That's a lovely way to end the class, is by relax. Don't be anxious that you're not some great enlightened, you know, being yet. Take things a step at a time. Work from wherever you are. Wherever you are, that's the best place to be. And it's the absolute right place to be. And if you focus on the tools you have around you, the opportunities you have around you, now you can begin to make progress toward those higher stages. So if you're not yet at that place where you can envision that love for Krishna, you've got Krishna's devotees here. And we can practice loving one another right here. And on that note, we're going to be instituting, we said we were going to do this. This is a lovely prayer.
Plugs are not there yet. I don't know what happened.
Yeah. Well, it's a prayer to the Vaishnavas, and you are all Vaishnavas, or servants of Krishna. And the prayer goes like this: Vancha kalpa tru vyascha kripa sindhu vyayivacha patitanam pavanevyo vaishnavevyo namo namaha. If you'd like to repeat that with me, I will do a line at a time. Vancha kalpa turu vyascha. Vancha kalpa turu vyascha. Kripa sindhu vyaevacha. Kripa sindhu vyaevacha. Patita nam pavanebhyo. Patita nam pavanebhyo. Vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. Vaishnavebhyo namo namaha. Roughly translated, this prayer means, I offer from the bottom of my heart my love and appreciation to all of you sincere devotees of Krishna, because you are all like desire trees. You are wish-fulfilling trees who can give the fruit of the needs of everyone. You can fulfill everyone's wishes. And you are always full of compassion for the souls of this world, the fallen souls who don't yet have Krishna consciousness or bhakti in their life. So that's a wonderful Vaishnava prayer to all of you. Rodney.
Okay, about the first thing I would say in the beginning about what the self is.
We're going to make it brief because we're running
inside.
A little late.
You've got to find the truth inside, and that'll make you decide which real is of what you're looking for. And that is how you start, and that will be your practice. This way you have something to realize later on. You're lucky you're here today. You got this body now, and this is where it's at. You what you're looking for, you have to do it now. If you weren't here tomorrow, you wish you had did it today. The best thing is to practice every day. Because lucky that you got this body, mind, and spirit, it's beautiful. So you know the truth, what you're looking for, that'll help you practice. But for the mind control is practice.
Yes. That's the message of this verse from the Gita today. Well, thank you. What have we got there?
Strawberries.
No strawberries.
Oh, we also have little chocolates, and we also have gluten-free chocolates.
Gluten-free. Vegan chocolate cupcakes and strawberries. All right. Starting next week, thank you, Rod. Starting next week, we're going to begin class at 7:45. So classes will be from 7:45 to 9. You will all get out of here by 9 o'clock from now on.
So we'll just do RG on your comments.
That's fine. Thank you all so much. See you next week. Next week, our guest is Vishwambar from the Mayapuris. So please try to come. Thank you. I'm going to take. I'll take. If there's anything left over, I'll bring it home to my family.
Okay.
Thank you.